Hello, this is the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Ricky Muir's election to the Senate on just 0.5% of the primary vote in 2013 was, for some, emblematic of a broken system. The government and the Greens have done a deal to this week pass Senate voting reform legislation that will mean micro-parties with tiny percentages of the vote, such as Muir's Motoring Enthusiast Party, will find it near impossible to enter on murky preference deals in the future. The legislation will also pave the way for the government to call a double dissolution election without a new batch of crossbench senators being elected. Today, Ricky Muir joins us as he fights what seems to be an impossible battle to stay in the political game. Ricky Muir, thanks for joining us today. This all seems a futile battle, doesn't it? The voting change is going through. There's nothing further you can do.
Yeah, look, the battlefield's certainly very active at the moment, but at the end of the day, A lot of these changes that the government and the Greens are coming in alliance to actually try to achieve are out of our control. But as history will dictate, my name will be used as the reason why all this happened. So I'm making sure that I'm trying to raise as much awareness as I can so people can realise that these changes aren't what they're made out to be and that I won't take it down lying.
Now, while you've undoubtedly benefited from the Senate voting system as it currently stands, do you appreciate that some change is needed? Do you agree that it is undemocratic that someone like yourself, frankly, could be elected with such a little amount of public backing, direct public backing?
I'll answer that backwards, actually. So I wouldn't say that it's undemocratic that somebody like myself can be elected. For 32 years, that's been the system the way it is. The major parties have most certainly benefited from it, and if the voters weren't actually choosing to look outside the major parties, this system will still suit them just fine. But do I appreciate that some kind of changes could happen? Absolutely. But it needs to be a long, thought-out, thorough process with proper public consultation. This bill that's been presented to the Parliament has been rushed through a committee process. Hasn't been discussed since the 2013 election. The JSCEM committee focused on the 2013 election. It did not focus on this current bill.
This is the parliamentary committee that...
That's right, the Joint Standing Committee on Electoral Matters, if that's right, going
that's
on.
That's right. So are you saying that it's not the change itself, but the process you're primarily objecting to, or do you think the change itself is misguided?
A bit of both, actually. So the process has been a token process. It is an absolute sham, it's a joke, and it's an insult to Parliament. When you have submissions taken until close of business, or it might have even been later, 8 p.m. of a Monday night, a committee process for 4 hours of the Tuesday morning. It could have been a Tuesday night, and then a Wednesday morning, the committee process, and then a chair's report handed down on the Wednesday night. That's a window period of just over 24 hours of submissions, committee, and a chair report tabled. It is nothing more than a token pre-written committee process with the likes of below-the-line amendments not being discussed until after the committee process. It becomes blatant obvious that it was nothing more than a token suggestion, which they had already discussed and decided to make it look like the committee process had worked. Mm. So the committee process, the whole process about electoral reform, it hasn't even really been put to the people, it hasn't been put to a vote by the people. It's a sham. It's a couple of parties trying to protect themselves. But also, the current bill as it is, with its savings provision, is so open to misleading the public and exhausting a lot of votes, making a lot of people who vote outside the major party exhaust their vote, therefore being informal. If the informal was on the major parties, they wouldn't be doing this at all.
When you say it's open to the public being misled, the proponents of the bill would say it's a simpler system.
Correct, and they are saying it's a simpler system, and with amendments I think it could be a much more simpler and fair system. They started speaking very positively about a minimum of six above the line. That's all good and fine, but they changed their rhetoric very quick in the public to 1 to 6. But what the public aren't hearing is 1 to 6 is the savings provision. There's six Senate positions in every election, in every half-Senate election. They put a savings provision in, so if people go and vote one above the line, it becomes a formal vote. There's no sunset clause on that savings provision because they know that for the last 32 years, people have been traditionally going one above the line. When a large party with large pockets can go and man a lot of polling booths across Australia at election time, people are going to see how to vote cards, which are pretty much all going to, I would suspect, encourage them to do an informal vote. It's going to benefit the majors and the minor parties. That's where your vote exhausts. Even if you did 1-2-6, the reality is, and Anthony Green's even pointed that out, that it's probably going to exhaust your vote, and your vote, no longer like under the current system, gets used until the very last person is elected.
So in summary, your position is some reform of the Senate voting system is needed, but a lot more thought needs to be given to it and a lot more time to discuss it. Is that where you stand?
Yeah, absolutely. If we're going to make changes to our electoral system that's going to affect the outcomes of elections forever, because once these changes come in, it's going to benefit the majors, they're not going to want to change it. It needs to be scrutinised properly, and that's the point of the parliament.
Now, concurrent with this argument this week, we've got another argument running, and that is if the government decides to bring forward the budget by a week, it would want the Senate back that week. The Greens and the Labor Party, and I presume a majority of the crossbench, are saying, no, we don't want the Senate to come back. What's your stand on the Senate coming back a week early?
I haven't put too much thought into it. I've been focused a lot on trying to move amendments to the trying to write amendments for the current electoral bill. But I do realise that the government do want to consider bringing the budget back to the 3rd of March. I don't have a strong position on that yet, but I'll be likely to support it being in the current time frame as it is, rather than actually bringing it back forward.
So you wouldn't be looking to bring the Senate back early to match an early budget?
There's not much appetite there, that's right.
Now, one of the things you were trying to do this week but didn't succeed was get the legislation for the Australian Building and Construction Commission considered this week. The government, because of the deal with the Greens, has put that legislation off. Do you think there would be a prospect of avoiding a double dissolution election if the crossbenchers agreed to support that legislation?
So to speak, yes, that would remove the possibility of that legislation being used as a trigger, but it's not a very good message to the government to say, you can coerce us by threatening us with our position and then we'll just bow down and do what you want. That's not parliamentary process at all. That's actually what they're claiming the ABCC bill is about in relation to unions and contractors.
Bit of stand-up tactics, you mean?
Absolutely. And it's actually quite an insult to the parliament that the Prime Minister would be actually even suggesting that perhaps we should just pass the ABCC and then he would pull back his threat of a double dissolution.
Do you think
election.
He would?
I don't know if he's got the courage now. Things are getting very, very late in the process. After I moved my amendment yesterday, I think it weakened the argument that the government can't get the ABCC debated in the chamber. I put it to them on a silver platter. They refused it because they were obviously worried that it would undo their deal with the Greens. I'm going to go back again today and move a motion to discuss the ABCC legislation in this sitting. But unlike my amendment from yesterday, it's not that it has precedence over electoral reform, but it should be dealt with in this sitting as well.
Which means it could be dealt with on May 10?
It could be dealt with before the budget as it currently sits, that's correct.
Now, you've opposed that legislation. What are your objections to it?
Last time it was rammed through the Senate and there was no talk of any compromise, but since then the waters were muddied. The registered organisation bill and what that's supposed to achieve was very mixed up in the debate around what the ABCC bill was supposed to achieve or is supposed to achieve. It's actually about breaches of civil law. That's what the ABCC is about. If you're speaking about corruption and so on, that's in the registered orgs bill. So the government really muddied those waters and it made it a very hard debate. So I've actually spoken very open and frankly with the Minister for Employment and said that you only need to clear those waters. And the debate in recent time really did focus on breaches of civil law, which I thought was absolutely fantastic. I've been having conversations with the government saying that I believe it needs to go into the Committee of the Whole in the Senate so amendments can be discussed. I know the likes of Senator Lionhelm had discussed or suggested an amendment for a sunset clause. I think there needs to be...
Which the government is willing to...
Correct. So the government said that they're willing to concede that. I've spoken about the coercive powers. Coming from the blue-collar background, I think a lot of supporters of myself would be very worried that the coercive powers could be, under the ABCC, could be a little bit too strong and open to manipulation. But currently under the FWBC, there is coercive powers that still are very useful for the department if they need to use it. So I think we should be discussing amendments around scaling the ABCC coercive powers back to what there currently is under the FWBC. That and a raft of other ideas which I think could be discussed. So there is no point going at the media and saying it's not going to get up when in reality people are wanting to discuss amendments to see if it can be scaled
down. So you are amenable if changes were made to possibly supporting the ABCC?
There was, providing that measures could be reached, that there was a possibility that they may have been able to get my support, providing that the more contentious parts of the bills were amended to suit. But because the government had actually built a very good working relationship with the crossbench, I'm a bit worried now that by coming on so hard and trying to blame the crossbench for all their downfalls, they may have done a lot of damage in other areas of the crossbench.
You say they built a good working relationship, but I think the government would say that it hasn't been able to get that relationship with the crossbench.
Yeah, it's kind of funny what goes on behind closed doors and then what is set out in the media. It's quite disappointing at times when you can see that we're sitting down having meetings as a crossbench with the government, at least discussing the legislation. Mm. We might be seven or eight crossbenches with all different views, but we're all trying to sit down and have discussions to see why the government's trying to do something. Mm. At the end of the day, there's plenty of people within the major parties who would... whisper in our ears every now and then that, geez, I wish I could go and sit over there with you, but they don't. At least we have the power of independence to actually go and do it. So, but Malcolm Turnbull did come on very strong in the beginning. He called every crossbencher his first day as Prime Minister personally and spoke to us on a name-to-name basis. And ministers seemed to get the talking notes that they should... actually meet with us and try to discuss what was going on, and everything looked very, very positive. But all of a sudden, just out of nowhere, because of a few bills that the government hasn't been able to get passed, which they haven't overly tried negotiating, they come out saying that we're essentially holding the country to ransom.
And didn't they try to negotiate this ABCC bill properly, you're saying?
No, not in the end. Yeah, I've been speaking productively with the minister, and I thought we're at a point where maybe...
This is Senator Cash.
That's right, that's Senator Cash. So I thought we're at a point where maybe there was a possibility of discussing this further in the chamber and seeing what agreement could be reached in the Committee of the Whole. And I really thought we were going down the right path, and all of a sudden the government's not wanting to put it on and saying that the crossbench is no longer allowing them to discuss it.
So was the real game here that the government, once it got the deal on Senate voting, thought we can have the DD, we can throw out these guys, and therefore we'll have an easier life? Is that
so
the thinking?
I'm very much of the opinion that they needed the double dissolution to be held up, and I'm doing quotations for those listening in. They needed the double dissolution. They needed the ABCC to be held up so that way they had the double dissolution trigger. I've given them the opportunity once, and I'll give it to them again today. So it will be twice to discuss the ABCC legislation. at the end of the day, I think they're crazy to not accept it, because it may well get knocked down and then it becomes a clear trigger. If that's the case, they're no longer misleading the public by saying that the Senate's not trying to actually discuss this. They're actually being truthful. It was rejected. We have a clear trigger. And then that's going to put the Greens in a position, I suppose, where they're going to have to consider electoral reform, because by default they'll be allowing the passage of the ABCC legislation.
But if it's a trigger, the government has the double dissolution, it wins the election, it gets that bill through the joint sitting. You've done nothing to thwart that bill, and yet the crossbenchers will have removed themselves, or most of them will be removed by the election, and there'll be less of a check in the system, let alone the fact that several of you will have cut short your political careers. Wouldn't it have been better to compromise on that bill for the sake of preserving yourselves collectively and individually for another 4 years?
I think that goes back to what I just said about by default the Greens would actually be supporting the passage of the ABCC legislation if it did become a clear trigger. If it goes to that joint sitting, if there's no diverse crossbench, the reality is the government's going to get through everything that they want to get through.
Exactly. So there's an interest. You could argue that there's a principle in preserving the crossbench, as apart from the expedient interest that there obviously would be.
That's correct. If the whole crossbench was going to go in and vote for the ABCC legislation, it will remove that trigger, and it would ensure that at least for this term of Parliament, or for the rest of our term in Parliament, we will be here potentially. We don't know how the 2016 election results are going to turn out with or without reform, so we may not be a balance of power anymore. But by doing that, there is every chance that could happen, but I don't see it panning out that way.
Now, if there is a double dissolution, would you put your hand up for re-election?
Most definitely. As it currently is, if there's a double dissolution under the current system, there's a good chance that other people still be able to stand up and try to have a say. But under the proposed changes, it's going to make it very hard for a start-up party to ever get anywhere. So I think as my name's been used as a scapegoat for this, it would be a responsibility to actually try to stand up and use the profile that I've built to try to ensure that those who are looking for somebody outside the major parties still have a voice.
Would you still be running for the Motoring Enthusiast Party?
Yeah, there's no reason why I wouldn't. The party's still around. And
what's happened to it anyway? I think most of us didn't really ever get our heads around this party.
Oh, look, it's still there and working quite hard in the background to around the party platform. It was a bit of a bumpy ride for everybody in the beginning, but everybody stuck together. Yeah, exactly right. Now, look, I don't think that's uncommon for start-up parties, especially considering it was only a few months before the 2013 election that the party even formed. So, there's a lot of dedicated people still in the background, still working away hard. We are a minor party.
What's your platform these days? Incidentally, I notice we're here in your office and you have some rather nice pictures of very old cars.
So, look, I think the platform, to begin with, it was a Motoring Enthusiast Party. And, look, that's exactly what the party and the platform stands for. But we were always aware that the Senate has to deal with every piece of legislation that the government wants to put through. So then the idea is to have certain core values rather than actually policy positions, because we're not in the lower house. We can't actually put policy forward, so to speak. Mm. And it's just how we review legislation as it comes through. And, I've been doing that as per the party core values. They're very open values, which I think most people generally support when they actually see them. And, the role of the Senate is to review legislation and I like to look back at my personal experience a lot, but also that of people within the community, and not just the very highly paid lobbyists that get to walk around Parliament House, but the people on the street who could never afford to pay a lobbyist to represent them.
Just to come back to here in Canberra, you mentioned about Malcolm Turnbull and his early overtures when he was first Prime Minister to the crossbench. How have you found him since then? And I'm curious as to why you didn't go to the dinner at the Lodge.
Sorry to your listeners, I'll take a swig of water right at that moment. The dinner for the Lodge, in the end, come late of an evening, that's when we found out that the reality is that we're probably going to be going to a double dissolution election. It had a very Last Supper-y feel to it, but I decided in that moment...
A sparse Last Supper, according to one of your colleagues.
Well, absolutely.
Who had to go to McDonald's afterwards.
No, for me, it really was, all right, we're probably going to be going to campaign mode here. I need to be back in my electorate, which is Victoria, speaking to people out on the street. And, of course, if I'm about to go into campaign mode, my kids aren't going to see me for a good, well, potentially 8 weeks, if that ends up being the length mm-hmm. of the campaign. So... I carpe diem, as I say, seize the moment. I thought, well, here's an opportunity to go and spend some time in the electorate and with my family before things really heat up. So I did decline, politely, of course. But that aside, if the circumstances were slightly different, there was no hard feelings. I still would have turned up. You've got to be pragmatic in this place. Unfortunately, there's always going to be somebody out trying to chop you off the knees, or pat you on the back with one hand and stab you in the back with the other. It's the nature of politics.
And so you don't dine with them if that's their motive, you think?
Oh, no, I'll certainly dine with them. Just, like I said, under the circumstances of that day, just in the end it was a better option to do the 6-7 hour trip back home and be in the electorate.
So how would you describe your relationship with Malcolm Turnbull at the moment?
I think it's
Doesn't it exist at all?
I will sit down and speak to the Prime Minister. Again, that's the nature of the job. It's always going to be political. but by singling my name out and trying to accuse the Senate of not passing legislation, where at the end of the day the government's just really not putting any effort into it, it is damaging. But if we were to get through... without a double dissolution and we continue our full terms, just like everybody else in this place, I suppose you just let wounds heal and continue to do what we're here to do.
You obviously feel very much you're being made the scapegoat for everything that's happening, and you're riled by this.
Yeah, very much. The government loves to mention 0.51% or the Motoring Enthusiast Party or Ricky Muir or whatever it may be, that they have a very strong focus on singling myself out, forgetting to mention the 13 people from the major parties who were elected on less of a percentage than myself.
Now, who have you found it easiest to work with in the government?
That's a really good question. I wouldn't say there's any single person. But the likes of Simon Birmingham, he's always been pretty good to speak to. Bridget McKenzie I get along with quite well. Even up until recently, conversations with Michaela Cash have been very positive. Senator Betts in the past, he always put a lot of effort into at least trying to explain, or at least trying to contact me. I was very bad at answering my phone in the beginning, but he'll make contact to try to discuss what the government was up to. We generally had polar different views, but at least we could have that conversation and even have a bit of a laugh about having different views. So there's a few people within the government that I think are good representatives. I think they're just very bound by party positions and party politics.
You mentioned not answering the phone much in the beginning. I do get the impression that over this past couple of years, you've become a lot more confident as a political player and more accessible, and found life not easier, but easier to deal with. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, the learning curve is really steep. Everybody knows that I had no political background, so it wouldn't be a surprise for people to hear that, you know, I even had to draw that line between state and federal politics in the very beginning. That's the senator elect stage before I took my seat. So the, I was going through a lot of self-training, so to speak.
What was that line? You mean you were a bit blurry on what was state and what was federal?
Yeah, so some issues that I thought I would have liked to champion might have actually been state issues. Right. You're like, well, hang on, okay, I can't go down that path, so I better not speak to that minister about that issue and so on. Yeah. So I was very, while I was on that learning curve, I thought, well, I'm just going to stay, you know, sit back a little bit, be quiet and learn exactly how the federal parliament works. So that way I know who I should be dealing with and how I should be tackling the issue I want to speak about. And then, of course, you have the government come on, all of a sudden they're wanting to speak to you about immigration or universities or various different things which I've never really had to deal with before. So I thought, well, okay, while that was going on, I'll sit back and educate myself about that specific issue before picking the phone up and returning a call. And then the nature of the job being the at the time I was very inaccessible to the media, to other parliamentarians, to people wanting to give advice. The backlog of calls was enormous, so I was very hard to get hold of.
So now you do feel much more confident, obviously, as a player.
Yeah, absolutely. Once I found my feet, I think I'll be continuously finding my feet no matter how long I'm involved with politics, and people who have been in this building for 20 years tell me exactly that. You still learn something new every day, but just like everything, as you get more and more used to it, it just becomes part of your daily life. And certainly my role as a senator is now part of my 24/7 daily living, so I'm very comfortable now.
Politics in the blood.
I think it is now. I remember reading an article about a previous sitting member who said, the problem is with this place, once you're out, you find yourself still hanging around. It becomes addictive, and I can see how that would happen.
What's been your most satisfying achievement in the past couple of years?
Finding my feet would be the most satisfying one, considering we're just on that topic. But there's a variety of different things. The debate around the inclusion of woody biomass in the renewable energy target, that was something I was quite passionate about, coming from the timber industry and knowing that a lot of the scare campaigns around it was strongly driven by extreme environmentalist groups. But there was an element of legitimate concern that had to be addressed. So that was actually a really fun learning process for me, because that was one of the first things I thought, oh, I'm going to champion this, knowing that it's unpopular amongst some supporters because they actually don't really know what this may do. It's been misrepresented. So trying to represent something that was relatively unpopular and maintain a support base was really, that was actually quite fun and exciting. And thankfully, just as I suspected, once the inclusion of woody biomass did get through into the renewable energy target, forests aren't being bulldozed just to burn. It hasn't happened. So just as I suspected, all it did was really highlight that the timber industry in Australia is sustainably managed, and it gave a possibility for leftover residues to be used. But as of yet, to the best of my knowledge, it hasn't even been utilised. But that wouldn't be my key achievement. Things like the Fair Work Amendment, ideologically, Labor and the Greens would oppose the likes of the Fair Work Amendment Bill, and there was elements in that which affected right of entry, which was a concern to me, was a concern to many people. But I was able to then suggest to the government, like, this bill actually includes the Greenfields agreements, and I agree we shouldn't be stalling projects that haven't even started for years while trying to reach an agreement. We should give that ability for an employer to go to the Fair Work Commission if need be and seek a resolution, but it should be at a reasonable time frame, so that way general bargaining can actually be done on the lead up to try to reach an agreement and get the project off the ground. So I was able to take the contentious parts out of that bill and get the good aspects of it up and running and break that deadlock between left and right politics. Those sort of things are things that I'm really proud of and would like to see myself continue to try to achieve into the future. But if the voters of Victoria aren't happy with that, they will certainly reflect that in the polls.
Now, if the polls do go against you, what next for Ricky Muir?
Great question. Like I said, I will definitely campaign. I think I said publicly a little while ago that I'll become a lobbyist. And I realised in saying that I actually said the wrong thing. I will certainly champion things that I'm passionate about. Now that I have an understanding how Parliament works, I think I might become one of those people that for some reason still just hang around. But I think being a four-wheel driver, a dirt bike rider, a law-abiding firearm owner, somebody who genuinely cares about the environment, there's a lot of things there I could actually champion just by trying to still have a voice at Parliament.
So you would seriously consider going into the lobbying industry?
Not lobbying as such, just certain aspects of it that I think are misrepresented within the public that need to be represented. I would happily try to get people motivated and teach them how to...
as a source of employment, though, I mean.
Oh, well, as a source of employment, I don't think I would. I don't think I could handle actually lobbying issues that I don't necessarily agree with. So as a source of employment, I don't know. I'd like to get into a bit of filming outside of this. I think that'll be fun. I would most certainly still look at the likes of state parliament, federal parliament into the future. I think there's a possibility that I'd try to stand up and run again. But of course, that's up to the voters to decide if and when I go down that path.
Ricky Muir, thanks for talking with us today in what's a very big week for you and the Senate.
Thank you very much.
And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back with another interview soon.